Hello there. Today, the story of how one line in an underground play inspired a worldwide campaign against Muslim fundamentalism.
And in one scene, a group of his young followers are playing music. This mirrors events in Mali, for example. And they're told they can't play music because of a fatwa, a religious order. And one of the young men says, "Your fatwas do not apply here."
Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Andrew West. We'll speak soon with the Algerian-American writer Karima Benoun about her new book, Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, the story of Muslims fighting back against extremists hijacking their faith. Now, on Sydney's normally serene northern beaches on Monday, a group of religious leaders occupied Tony Abbott's electorate office. They conducted a three-hour prayer vigil as part of their campaign to release more than 1,000 children held in Australian-run immigration detention centres. The clergy included a Catholic priest and ministers from the Baptist and Metropolitan Community Churches. At the same time, a group of clergy was also occupying the electoral office of opposition leader Bill Shorten in Melbourne, and they included the former national president of the Uniting Church, the Reverend Alastair McRae. The most senior cleric arrested at Mr. Abbott's office is the moderator of the Uniting Church in New South Wales and the ACT, the Reverend Dr. Brian Brown. Dr. Brown is speaking with RN's Noel Debien.
Yes, Noel, actually it is the first time I've been arrested.
What has brought you to say, yes, I would actually take the consequence of being arrested? What got you across the line?
One thing is the seriousness of the issue. Professor Patrick McGorry, a former Australian of the Year, has called the detention centres mental illness factories, putting children in situations where we know 100% that they are going to suffer mentally and perhaps suffer mental illness as a result. It's just appalling. I think it's also the church, including the Uniting Church and others, have been trying to speak to power about this for a long time, and we're just not getting a reasonable response. Just recently we contacted Scott Morrison, Minister for Immigration, to say that we as a Uniting Church would be happy to take the 30 children that he was planning to send from Christmas Island to Nauru. We would take them and look after them, and we just didn't get a response. The Baptist Church has offered temporary accommodation to asylum seekers, and again, they just didn't get a response. I had to ask myself the question, is it appropriate for a moderator of the Uniting Church to do this? But as a spokesperson for the Synod of New South Wales ACT, I decided it was appropriate.
Well, it was you and also the former national president, Alastair McRae, too, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, and that was encouraging to know that he had said yes, and that sort of helped me.
Well, Alastair is like, compared to other church leaders, say, Sir Ronald Wilson was another national president, wasn't he?
He was indeed. We don't like to talk in hierarchies in the Uniting Church, but the national president is pretty much a high office.
So the both of you decided you would go to this action. What happened?
The action was planned for 10 a.m. in the Prime Minister's office. We met at 8 at a local church and we were briefed.
This is down Manly, near Manly Village?
Yeah, Manly Village Uniting Church.
There were 8 of you, I think, in total?
There was a much larger group in total, but there were 8 who were prepared to actually stay in the Prime Minister's electoral office long enough to be arrested if that's what the police decided to do.
The aim being that in refusing to leave, you would be drawing attention to this issue, I gather.
Dramatising the issue, I think, is the best way I would put it. In a small symbolic way, we were prepared to be detained on behalf of people who are being detained in the most awful way. There is a very strong ecumenical group across a number of denominations who are totally dissatisfied with the way that the government and the opposition are dealing with people in detention, and particularly children.
So you arrived as a group at the electoral office, then what happened?
About 10 or 11 of us went up, then sat, apart from our leader, who then spoke to the office staff.
What did that leader say?
He just said why we were there, that we were concerned about children in detention, and we'd come and we would be staying until we got a response from the Prime Minister that would indicate to us that the government was rethinking its policy.
Then what happened?
The office manager was called and she queried whether we had actually written to the Prime Minister and to our local members.
Through the proper channels, in
other words. Yeah, through the proper channels. When we said through our spokesperson that we had exhausted all channels, she invited us to write something there and then that she would then communicate to the Prime Minister. We didn't feel that that was going to be fruitful. We intended to stay in the office until we heard from the Prime Minister that they were rethinking the policy. She eventually told us that we were in fact now trespassing, and that if we didn't leave, then she would be calling the police. We said that we understood that, but we would be staying.
You were also praying together, were you?
We had a liturgy of prayers and readings, which was conducted while all of this was going on.
Did the Prime Minister respond in any way?
There was a lot going on in the back office, and eventually the office manager came and said she had a statement from the Prime Minister.
So he took the time, in other words, to speak to
him? Well, he had been contacted in Queensland about this. This statement was then read. It ended with a statement that their policy was that this matter of children in detention is best resolved by stopping the boats, which we didn't consider satisfactory.
So the police arrived?
The police arrived. They indicated to us that we had been asked to leave, and failure to leave meant that we were at risk of being arrested for breaching the peace. More police were called. Eventually, I think there were about 14 or 15 police officers.
And then you were arrested?
Yes, so I went with two police officers. Once we were in the lift, the duty officer said to me, "You've been arrested for breaching the peace. You are going to be taken outside and released without charge."
As I understand it, the action that was happening simultaneously in Bill Shorten's office in Melbourne did produce some result.
There was some movement, but at the end of the day, literally, that group stayed, I think, until closing time, 5 p.m. before they were arrested and removed from the building.
Indeed, I understand that right now they're meeting with the Shadow Minister for Immigration.
We're very encouraged by that. We believe that all people of goodwill should be able to see the reasonableness of our position. This is not satisfactory to deal with anyone really in this way, but particularly children. So we'd be very grateful for any movement, either from the opposition, as seems to be the case, or from the government.
The moderator of the Uniting Church in New South Wales and the ACT, the Reverend Dr. Brian Brown, speaking with Noel Debien. And as you heard, a church delegation is meeting with the federal opposition about now concerning children in detention. We're yet to hear the outcome of that meeting in Geelong. We'll give you the details if we do hear some outcome. This is the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West. Your fatwas do not apply here. They're the defiant words of a Muslim playwright in Pakistan, determined to fight his country's growing fundamentalism. It's also the title of a new book by the Algerian-American law professor Karima Bannoun. She documents the stand that Muslims themselves are taking against extremists trying to hijack their religion. From Africa to Indonesia, Karima Bannoun celebrates the feminists and the jazz musos, the lawyers and the clerics who are pushing for a more liberal practice of Islam. But she also challenges both the left and the right in the West over the way they've handled Muslim fundamentalism. Karima Bannoun is in Australia for the Sydney Writers Festival, and I caught up with her earlier.
One of the things that I challenge in my book is the idea that the issue of Muslim fundamentalism is about a clash of civilizations between the West and the East. What I argue instead is that there is a clash within civilizations between democrats and theocrats, and I am talking about the part of that struggle that's happening across Muslim-majority countries.
Let's define some terms, because you are quite deliberately very particular. What are the terms that you prefer when framing this debate? Because it is very important.
Yes. So I use the term fundamentalism, which is a controversial term, and I cite the definition given by the Algerian sociologist Mariamme Elie Lucas, who says that fundamentalisms, and note the S, not just within Islam, fundamentalisms are political movements of the extreme right that in a context of globalization manipulate religion to achieve their political aims. Mm. And the political nature of these movements is very important to me.
And you have a very neat sentence which captures this. You say three letters makes the difference, that Islam and Islamism are not the same thing, and those three letters are critical.
Absolutely, and I think all too often these concepts are assimilated. Islam is one of the world's great religious traditions. There are 1.5 billion people of that heritage in the world today. Islamism, on the other hand, is a political ideology that uses a particular interpretation of Islam as a tool to take power. And some of those who have been the staunchest opponents of Islamism are deeply religious, practicing Muslims.
And you tell some of their stories, and I want to ask you about those in a moment. You say that you are explicitly not on the same side as the anti-Islam demagogues. You're not a supporter of the Iraq War. You're certainly not a supporter of George Bush. So whose side are you on, Karima?
Well, in the book, I challenge both the right and the left in the West in the way that they have interpreted and used this issue. And I feel like on parts of the right, I should say, there has been a certain racist discourse that suggests that all Muslims are fundamentalist or only Muslims are fundamentalist. Whereas on the left, in some quarters, one finds responses that are sort of too politically correct to acknowledge that this is a problem at all. And what I'm trying to do is to find a different way of talking about these things, which is neither of those two discourses.
Well, tell me a little bit about your own background, because you speak with a very strong American accent, but of course, Karima Benoun, a name that hails from Algeria, and that's a very important part of your identity in telling this story.
I am the daughter of an Algerian father and an American mother. I'm what they used to call in the U.S. a third culture kid. I grew up back and forth between the countries of my parents. My attitudes on this issue are very much informed by my family experience in Algeria. So my dad was a professor of anthropology at the University of Algiers and was active in the independence movement against France back in the 50s and 60s, later came to be very outspokenly critical of the fundamentalists in the 90s during the terrible conflict in the country, and then began to receive death threats.
Because you're a Democrat, it might surprise a lot of our listeners to read in this book that you have very grave reservations about what we now know as the Arab Spring. I mean, what's the basis of those reservations?
Well, I want to be very clear that I support the movement for justice and democracy across Arab-majority countries, no question about it. I think that those popular movements in the early days in 2011 were incredibly inspiring. The problem then is that when you have this political opening that is then exploited by extremist movements, fundamentalist movements, the Muslim Brotherhood and Nahda and so on, who are better organized than their sort of secular opponents, you end up with this paradoxical situation where the process of democracy is used against substantive democratic principles. And what I firmly believe, based on my experience in Algeria, is that the struggle for democracy in the Arab world and the struggle against fundamentalism have to go together. And I support both of those struggles.
And it's been let down in your book in three places in particular, Egypt most prominently. I mean, tell me the story of Egypt that troubles you so much.
Well, I mean, it's heartbreaking to see that people who started off opposing Mubarak because of his terrible repression then ended up in a period of time ruled by somebody that they began to believe was going to be a worse dictator, a theocratic dictator, Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president, and now succeeded by a new military crackdown. This is not at all what those who launched the 2011 movement were seeking. What they wanted was more freedom, not less. But I think it's really important, again, not to oversimplify what they were fighting for. I do believe that one of the things they were fighting for was equality and human rights. And I'm afraid both the Muslim Brotherhood and the military fail on those scores. So the challenge now is to construct another alternative, which is neither of those two things.
In Egypt in particular, you raise the fact that female genital mutilation began to be justified. People began to think, well, maybe it does have a place in official Egypt in the post-revolutionary period.
FGM is widely practiced in Egypt and also has been illegal for a number of years. But the Muslim Brotherhood, during their time in power, very strongly promoted the practice. They were said to have mobile medical teams that went out to villages and actually encouraged the practice and would offer to perform it for free, something that was strongly opposed by Egyptian human rights groups. We saw even in Tunisia, where female genital mutilation is not practiced, that Ennahda allowed Salafist preachers to come in from outside and to begin to advocate FGM.
And Ennahda was the Islamist force viewed in the West as sort of soft and maybe acceptable.
Yes, they're regularly labeled in the Western press as moderate. And as a former Tunisian student of mine said, moderate seems to mean that you only target your own people, not Westerners. Meanwhile, on the ground, Ennahda and certainly the hardliners in Ennahda were clearly advocating changing Tunisia, moving it away from the more secular, more socially liberal country that it has been, even while being very politically closed in Ben Ali's time. So again, using a revolution which is supposed to be about moving forward to instead attempt to push backward.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, our special guest this week, Dr. Karima Bannoun. She's the author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, and it tells the story of the fight against Muslim fundamentalism by leading Muslims themselves. Karima, let me talk now about the frustrations that you've identified in the way that both sides of politics deal with questions of Muslim fundamentalism. You think the left in particular, and in so many ways you are a woman of the left, but you think the Western left has been particularly negligent in this area. How?
Well, I think there has been a use of the logic of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So somehow some on the left in the West seem to think that because Muslim fundamentalist movements sometimes claim to be the opponents of the West, or Western governments sometimes claim to be battling terrorism, that this makes the Muslim fundamentalist movement somehow palatable or anti-imperialist. I think this is a gross error, and I think it sells out the left on the ground, which is very often on the front lines of struggling, even at risk of their very lives, against these fundamentalist movements. And we've seen this in the way that, you know, leading Muslim fundamentalist figures like Anwar Awlaki, like Muazzam Beg in Britain, have been whitewashed by the left and by human rights movements. And again, I shouldn't generalize. It's not everyone on the left, but there is a certain discourse.
Yeah, but I mean, you make two particular references, or, you know, several references to two venerable human rights organizations, one of which you were deeply involved in, Amnesty International USA, but also Human Rights Watch, where you think those historically venerable groups have made some real strategic errors in the way that they've treated the fundamentalists, don't you?
Well, I think that, as I say in the book, these are organizations that have done very important work, most of which I support. But I have disagreed with Amnesty International, my former employer, on a number of issues. One was their very close embrace of a man named Muazzam Beg, who was a former Guantanamo detainee, a British Muslim. And I certainly opposed the way that he was treated by the United States. But at the same time, this is somebody who had been in and out of jihadi training camps. And when the head of their gender unit criticized Amnesty for doing this work, they actually fired her.
But he was put up on the Amnesty International website, I think, at one point as some sort of poster boy. And the organization that he began, Cage Prisoners, I think it was called, was held up as a great liberation movement.
Yes, and actually Cage Prisoners is a very problematic organization that in fact defends jihadist prisoners who have been convicted in fair trials of terrorism-related offenses. Mm. So this is not exactly a human rights agenda. And, you know, Amnesty's not alone in this. This is not one solitary case. I think part of it was a very strong reaction to the terrible policies of a number of governments, including the U.S. government in the war on terror, and people got caught up in sort of responding and forgot that sometimes you have to be critical in multiple directions at the same time.
The right wing, though, you also are very critical of them. And the right wing, in its critique of Islamic fundamentalism, you point out that it's gone to some very dark places indeed.
Mm-hmm. One thing that was important for me to explain in my book is I am, in fact, very proud of my Muslim heritage. This is not an anti-Islam book. And I was amused because one of the right-wing groups in the U.S., Jihad Watch, actually published an attack on my book saying, you know, this book is not what it purports to be. It's not an attack on Islam. And I was thrilled because they understood. It's not at all. It's a defense of a certain liberal, progressive Muslim tradition. And and, you know, people of Muslim heritage who have different views about religion. So I really disagree with this attempt to use the critique of jihadist movements and of terrorism for a racist anti-immigrant agenda, which is not my agenda at all. Again, I'm looking for my own independent feminist political space from which to talk about these things, grounded in the lived experiences of the people on the front lines, who I think are much more important than our theories about them.
You referred earlier to the way the West has used the phrase moderate to refer to groups like Ennahda and other organisations, other figures within the Muslim world. It suits the West, doesn't it, at times to characterise groups as moderate? And yet their only moderation is that they don't believe necessarily in war.
For me, it's not possible to be moderate and advocate theocracy at the same time. Those two concepts do not go together. For me, the real moderates are those who may be believers, who may be practicing, who may be agnostics, who may be atheists, who may be free thinkers, who are challenging the political manipulation of religion. And I think that's something we've really got to understand outside.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, this week our special guest, Karima Bannoun, author of Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, the story of Muslims fighting extremism. And Karima is in Australia for the Sydney Writers Festival. Now, one of the very interesting points that you make in the book, and it challenges conventional Western thinking, it certainly challenged mine, is that you dispute the idea that the rise of fundamentalism is in some way a response to globalization, because you say it's its own globalized form of Islam, that it's not in any sense sensitive to local conditions, local expressions of Islam.
I think that's such an important point. And here I was drawing on the work of the really brilliant Moroccan anthropologist Hassan Rashik, who talks about Muslim-majority societies now facing multiple forms of globalization, what he calls Western globalization and what he calls Islamic globalization. Very often, the fundamentalist movements which operate transnationally are about changing people's local lived practices of Islam, whether it's changing the garments that women are wearing, whether it's changing in North Africa, for example, the worship at sites where local saints are buried is very important. Fundamentalists absolutely oppose this. So it's really about imposing a certain Wahhabi Gulf region model on the rest of these regions in a way that's completely inappropriate.
Yeah, and what happened in Mali with the Muslim women in Mali?
So the jihadist movements took over the northern part of Mali for most of 2012. And during that time in the north, they imposed corporal punishments. They imposed strict dress codes on women, veiling in garments that women in that region had never worn before. Women were not able to work. And there's a great tradition of women working in commerce in Mali, including in northern Mali. Music was banned. Mm. Smoking was banned. People had limbs cut, allegedly, for theft when it wasn't even clear whether they had stolen anything. There was a destruction of the cultural heritage, the mausolea, the manuscripts. So a real attempt to change northern Mali and the culture of the area. And that was not only driven by Malian armed men, but armed men who came from Algeria. The allegedly Boko Haram was operating there. So this is truly a transnational problem.
Yeah, and this was the Muslim women's own dress, the local dress. It was colourful. There was music. There was an international music scene there, none of which at the time was considered incompatible with Islam.
Absolutely. This is simply a part of the way that people have lived. And in West Africa, there's a real tradition of these countries being secular republics. They may be Muslim-majority countries, Mali, Niger, Senegal, and so on, but they consider themselves secular states. And people have always understood those two things as being entirely compatible. But the fundamentalists have really sought to change that view.
Now, that term, your fatwa, does not apply here. Like all good writers, you've actually purloined it from one of your sources. Where did you hear that? And what does it represent?
Absolutely. That comes from the writing of the brilliant Pakistani playwright Shahid Nadeem, who wrote a beautiful play called Bulle, which is about a Sufi mystic in Pakistan in the 18th century who was battling the fundamentalists of his day. And in one scene, a group of his young followers are playing music. This mirrors events in Mali, for example. And they're told they can't play music, be because of a fatwa, a religious order, and one of the young men says, your fatwas do not apply here. And I borrowed the line from there. And in fact, after Wole Soyinka, the great Nigerian writer, talked about the book in the wake of the terrible Westgate attack in Nairobi, people in Africa began to tweet, your fatwa does not apply here, as an anti-terrorism slogan. So these wonderful words from Pakistan were traveling across to Africa.
Well, there are some maybe unlikely heroes in the book. Tell me about the mullah that you met in Herat.
That's a wonderful story. So the mullah, as I call him, the liberal mullah of Herat, is an older gentleman who is a religious scholar in Herat in western Afghanistan, who calls himself a women's human rights defender. Now, his view of women's rights and mine might not be exactly the same, but he was out there campaigning when I met him against forced marriage, against early marriage, and for women's equality. In fact, when I ran into him, he was running a human rights seminar for Afghan women in Herat. And he was so glad that somebody had come to interview him from overseas and sort of to recognize his work, which he felt was really the kind of work that all too often simply isn't recognized. And he takes great security risks. What I'll never forget about the mullah from Herat is that he made sure to see me safely home before he went on home, despite the tremendous danger for him of being out at night, given the work that he's doing.
Just finally, Karima, there's a very, very powerful part of your book, a very, very powerful passage. You wrote a manifesto on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. It was called Why I Hate Al-Qaeda. I'd like you to read that section of your book now, an extraordinary manifesto. You found it difficult, I think, at times to get it published, but it's now found expression in this book.
Why I Hate Al-Qaeda, September 11th, 2011. To start, there are 2,975 reasons from 90 countries, an unforgettable patchwork quilt of humanity that was disappeared on a Tuesday morning 10 years ago. But that is only the beginning. I hate Al-Qaeda for all the human beings they have killed, the Africans, Americans, Arabs, Asians, Europeans, agnostics, atheists, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Muslims. I hate Al-Qaeda because they have murdered thousands of Muslims while claiming to represent them, a claim they make even while bombing mosques during Ramadan. Because they make the most sacred pronouncements like Allahu Akbar, God is great, into threats, into epithets. I hate Al-Qaeda because of the caliphate of doom they want to build. I hate Al-Qaeda because they hate women, gays, Jews, Christians, Muslims not like them, which is most Muslims. Because they only hate, and they make me hate too. I hate Al-Qaeda for the young Algerian fiancé who bled to death in his mother's arms in Cherchell after a suicide bombing broke his fast this August. For Mustafa Akkad and his daughter Rima. For Danny Pearl, Aminia Rasool, and Father Michael Judge, all of whom are no more because Al-Qaeda is. I hate Al-Qaeda for the bombs of Baghdad, of Algiers, of Amman, of Dar es Salaam, of all the cities they have blighted, like New York. I hate Al-Qaeda because they make it harder for people who look like my father to board an airplane, because they confirmed every racist's view of Muslims and provoked responses that confirmed every anti-American cliché. 10 years on, I am ready to stop hating Al-Qaeda. I am ready to stop Al-Qaeda.
Karima Bounoun, that was a very, very moving passage, a manifesto on why I hate Al-Qaeda. You can find it in Karima's new book, Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here, Untold Stories from the Fight Against Muslim Fundamentalism. Karima, thank you so much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks very much.
And Karima is not only speaking at the Sydney Writers' Festival, but also at the Australian Human Rights Centre at the University of New South Wales and at the Caston Centre at Monash in Melbourne. And there are details on the Religion and Ethics Report homepage at the RN website, which is where you can also download or stream our interviews. Thanks to producer Jess Hill and technical producer Paul Gough. Next, it's breakfast.